This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. In 1963, a landmark piece of federal legislation passed that required employers to pay men and women equally for equal work. When lawmakers in Washington approved the law, a woman was typically paid 59 cents for every dollar paid to her male counterpart. 50 years later, however, pay discrimination is still a real and persistent problem. In 2011, the most recent year data was available, American women working full-time year-round were typically paid just 77 cents for every dollar paid to their male counterparts. In Vermont, that gap is better. Women in Vermont typically earn about 85 cents for every dollar paid to a man doing a similar job, but it's still not equal. And that wage gap is our topic today on Vermont Edition. We'll talk about what's helped us get closer to achieving fair pay, but also some of the things that continue to hold women back. My guests are Carrie Brown, Executive Director of the Vermont Commission on Women, and Cheryl Hanna, a professor at the Vermont Law School and a regular commentator on VPR. Carrie Brown and Cheryl Hanna, it's great to have you on the show today.
Oh, thanks for having us.
So when you hear statistics like the ones I just read showing that nationwide the gender wage gap has only improved 18 cents in about 50 years, it's depressing. And when you talk about women of color, the wage gap is even larger. Cheryl Hanna, if there is a federal law and a state law on the books that says employers have to pay men and women doing similar jobs the same wages, why are we still seeing such a big gap?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons why men and women are still not making the same amount of money for performing similar work. One of them, even though, is that we have laws on the books. We don't often have a way to give life to those laws. So many women, for example, simply don't know that they're being paid less than men are being paid. Employers don't pay attention or think that they have justifiable reasons for paying people differently when they really don't. We can think back to the very well-publicized case of Lilly Ledbetter a few years ago, in which she did not know that she was being paid significantly less than her male counterparts at a tire facility until somebody left a photocopy of the wage salary table in her mailbox. And we hear those stories over and over again. And so we know that even when you control for things like education, experience, part-time work, we know that the wage gap endures because those laws, even though they're on the books, aren't really being given life.
Carrie Brown, the Vermont Commission on Women has been around for almost as long as the Federal Equal Pay Act. You're celebrating 50 years, I think this week, in fact.
Well, this year is our 50th anniversary. That's right.
And that work, what work, rather, has the commission done to narrow the wage gap in the last 50 years?
Well, this has been a dominant issue for the commission since day one. And we've been working on this since, as you said, the wage gap was 59 cents. And there's been a pretty significant improvement. Starting in the 60s, when people first started talking about this, the wage gap started shrinking, but then it plateaued. It really kind of eased off. And we haven't seen a lot of shrinkage in the past 15 years or so. And so we used to hold 59-cent hearings back in the 60s where we'd talk about this. And one of the things that we've done recently is work with a whole group of collaborators on creating some amendments to Vermont's own equal pay law, which passed last spring. The governor signed it in May. And that strengthened a lot of the equal pay laws that we already had on the books, as well as added some new ways to, as Cheryl said, kind of bring life to and put teeth into the laws that we already had.
And why is Vermont doing better than other states? Is it by and large due to efforts like your organization? Is it the fact that we have a lot of women as state lawmakers? I mean, our gap is quite a bit smaller than the national average. What can you point to in Vermont that we've done better?
Well, so I think that's a really good question. And I can't tell you definitively what the answer is, but I have some ideas. One is that our minimum wage is higher than most places in the country. And most of the people who work minimum wage jobs are women. We also have a somewhat higher percentage of public employees than the national average. And there's a smaller wage gap among public employees, which probably has to do with the transparency in wages, where there's no wondering how much do I make at this job? How much does my counterpart make? Because it's all open. It's all public. And there isn't room for negotiation. And one of the things that we find is that when women have to negotiate for salaries, they don't do it as often as men do, and they're not as successful as men are. So when you take that away, you see more equal pay.
I want to delve into that whole negotiation factor in a few minutes. A couple of comments here from listeners. Jen wrote in, I asked for a raise and was refused while a man with the same level of experience was given the amount for which I asked. Christina wrote in, I have tried negotiating a higher salary, and it was a struggle, and the man who followed me in the same position with less experience was paid double what I was being paid. That was an eye-opener. Although Robin wrote in on our Facebook page, I have negotiated a salary increase, and the employer respected me for it, too. I got the raise. I was, however, very nervous about the whole event. Listeners, you can join our conversation today. Have you experienced wage discrimination, and if so, how? And women listeners, what were your goals when you began looking for a job? Was it salary? Was it schedule? Was it potential for advancement? We'd love to hear from you today at 1-800-639-2211. Again, our number is 1-800-639-2211, or you can send us an email to Vermont Edition, and you spell that all out at vpr.net. Cheryl Hannah, someone might argue that if women make less in certain positions, it might be because their jobs may be different from that of a male counterpart. So when you look at the Equal Pay Act and you're trying to compare jobs and apples to apples, how do you do that? How do you compare jobs to make sure salaries are equal?
Right. And so the Equal Pay Act is very simple in how it's structured. And it simply says that if a male or, you know, if somebody of the opposite gender is getting paid more in the same or a similar position, that the employer has to have a bona fide legitimate business reason for doing so. And so when we were comparing jobs, you know, I don't know if you remember this, but when I was a little kid, when I was first learning to read, you would open up the newspaper and you would see help wanted ads for women and help wanted ads for men. And, you know, it would say help wanted.
Oh, I'd forgotten that.
Do you remember that? Uh-huh. Yeah, and that's now illegal. But if you remember, you know, even occupations publicly were sex segregated. So you would see maybe a job listed as a housekeeper and one listed as a janitor. And the janitor would get paid more and the housekeeper would get paid less, even though they were performing essentially similar work. And so when courts look at whether or not jobs are comparable, they don't look at the title. They look beyond the title to see what is the actual nature of the work that somebody is doing. So what are the responsibilities? What are the duties? And the courts have been very clear that people do not have to be doing exactly the same job or exactly the same work. But if the duties and responsibilities and expectations are similar, again, they don't have to be the same, but similar, that's enough to trigger an equal pay violation.
You Did What writes in, I'm a little confused. If a woman accepts a job at a specific rate and is happy with it, what's the problem? In most businesses, all the male employees do not make the exact same wage. They do not do the exact same work unless it's a production line, manufacturing, where your units per hour are recorded. To get upset because you find someone else in the firm negotiated a better deal, you have nobody to blame but yourself. Which brings us to this whole negotiating conundrum, if I can say that, because that seems to be a big issue that may be holding back. Carrie Brown, talk about where negotiating fits in and why that has been a limiting factor for women.
Sure. We know that women are less likely to negotiate when they're offered a job. They're less likely to negotiate their salary than men are. And we also know that when they do negotiate their salary, they end up with less money than men do. They're less successful at it. And so there are various reasons for this. Some of it is just having a different attitude about expectations. There's a strong link between your expectations for what you're going to get paid. If you have higher expectations, you're more likely to negotiate. And men tend to have higher expectations about their future pay. And but there is also a perception of a backlash that some women are afraid of. And that women are more successful when they negotiate on behalf of their team members or someone that they work with than when they negotiate on behalf of themselves. And unfortunately, there's actually some truth to the idea that there might be some backlash. There are negative associations that women face when they act aggressive and negotiate on their own behalf. They may face social backlash within the workplace. And so...
You mean that behavior being frowned upon where it's not ladylike, it's unattractive.
That's right. When there's a couple studies where they ask people in experiments, you know, would you want to work with this person? And they have different responses to a woman doing the same activity as a man, that they're less likely to want to work with them. They perceive it differently. So some of that fear that women face is... real. It's based on reality. And so that's something that where employers can be conscious of that and try to address that on their end as well.
Listeners, you can weigh into this conversation. 1-800-639-2211 is our number. We're talking about the wage gap, the gender wage gap here on Vermont Edition today. Let's go to the phone lines now. Let's go down to Rutland and talk to Kiki McShane. Hi, Kiki. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Nina. Thank you so much. I'm happy to be part of this great discussion.
And I should point out, Kiki is the Women's Professional Development Center director down in Rutland. And I understand there's actually a seminar that is going on right now on negotiating. Is that right?
There is. It's actually going to start in 10 minutes, and it's on the campus of Castleton College. And it's called How to Get More of What You Want, Positive Negotiation. And it's the main speaker is Cindy Cook. And it's part of Castleton's nationwide celebration of Women's History Month. And so we are co-sponsoring this event at Castleton as the Women's Professional Development Center and addressing very pertinent topic to what you've been talking about. And just are looking forward to Cindy starting in about 10 minutes.
So, Kiki, when you were hearing from various businesswomen in and around Rutland, different entrepreneurs, people hoping to get into business careers, was this whole negotiating thing something that they said they needed help with?
Yes, it is, as a matter of fact. We did two focus groups starting last summer. We did one in Chittenden County and we did one in Rutland County, so one in South Burlington and one in Rutland. And it was one of the things that was a recurring theme. And it said women let us know, women and girls let us know that they either felt uncomfortable negotiating, they didn't really know how to negotiate effectively. And it also is something that came up out of the Lean In circles that had been taking place under the direction of Mary Powell, that was something that came up also. So we really followed the trend that is national, but then also definitely applied to the folks here in our area. So, yes, we chose this as a topic because it was brought to our attention that there was a need in that area.
And one last question for women who are looking for more of this type of thing. Where can they get more information on the Women's Professional Development Center?
Well, our office is at 230 West Street in Rutland. They are more than welcome to stop by, or they can call 802-345-1252 and ask to speak with me.
All right. Well, we'll put that information on our website. Kiki McShane, thanks for calling in. I really appreciate that.
Oh, you're very welcome.
All right. And listeners, again, you can weigh into our conversation today by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or head over to Vermont Edition's Facebook page, and you can post your comments or questions there. Cheryl Hanna, you teach a course on salary negotiations at the Vermont Law School. What do you try to bring up to both your male and female students?
So I teach a course on gender in the law, and one of the things that I do with my students is I actually make them prepare for their first salary negotiation. I often tell the story about when I was negotiating for one of my first salaries. I was part of a loan forgiveness program. So if I made a certain amount of money, I had some of my loans forgiven. So when I went to negotiate my first salary, I actually asked for less money. And I often joke, which, you know, they taught me many things at Harvard, but math was not among them, because if they had taught me math, what I would have realized was that it would have been much better in the long run to pay back some of my own student loans. Even if I would have had a little bit of a short-term cash flow, I would have more than made up for that over the course of my life. Because when we talk about what your initial salary is, we know that that salary is compounded over time, because most wage increases are a percentage of salary. And so the higher salary you start with, the higher salary, the more you're going to earn over your lifetime. And of course, the less you negotiate for at the beginning, that compounds as well. So I have my students practice their first salary negotiations so they do not make the same mistakes I made. And what I have them first do is I have them go do research, because it's really always surprising to me how little we know about what jobs actually pay. So as Carrie mentioned, if there's jobs in the public sector, there's websites you can go on to see what the range of those jobs pay. But in the private sector and the nonprofit sector, you've really got to do some research. And so I have my students do research, and they go to the library and they go look things up, and it takes them some time, but you can find that out. out. They can also find that out by doing networking, the kind of phone calling to mentors and to colleagues and giving me a sense of what the salary range is because they need information. The second thing I have them do is to really have a good understanding of what they need to make, not just what that job pays. Because one of the better negotiating tools for women in particular is not to talk about what you deserve, but what you need. And that's particularly true for graduates graduating with student loans or who have family responsibilities. In other words, what in order to have a meaningful, sustaining lifestyle, what should you be earning? And the third thing I have them do is to also catalog what's important to them beyond salary. Is it professional development? Is it a flexible work time? Is it health care? Is it vacation time? Because I want people to think about not just how much they're going to earn, but what the range of things that will be in front of them. And then I have them practice, 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 and I have them practice different strategies to see how they sound and play. Because as Carrie was saying, we often feel really uncomfortable going in and saying, I need more money. It's really hard to do. We were laughing before the show about when we were all babysitters and somebody said to us, well, how much do you charge? And the response we all gave was, oh, whatever you're willing to pay me, right? Or I'll take my first offer. So we don't really even think that we deserve
it. I still cringe at that.
I know. It's terrible. So practicing really helps. And also cataloging what assets you bring to a position. So we know that when women negotiate salaries, they have a better strategy when they can talk about what they can help the organization do, what kinds of assets or special traits that they bring, how they're going to be a good team player because of this. Men tend to be more successful when they talk about their families or what they need or what they deserve. And women have very different strategies to employ.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the wage gap that exists between working men and women, why women are on average paid less than men, and what can and is being done about that. My guests are Vermont Law School Professor Cheryl Hanna and Carrie Brown, the Executive Director of the Vermont Commission on Women. You can join us at 1-800-639-2211 or by posting your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We'll get to calls when we come back. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, and today we're talking about why women in Vermont are still earning about 85 cents for every dollar a man earns. That's better than the national average, but not good enough. My guests are Carrie Brown, Executive Director of the Vermont Commission on Women, and Cheryl Hanna, Professor at the Vermont Law School. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. A listener called Male Matters asked this question: what is the gender wage gap at the companies owned by women? Which I think is a great question. Carrie Brown, is there any data on that?
That is a great question. We don't have data on that at the Commission on Women. We track a lot of information about how many women are in leadership positions, women in public life, women who are elected to the legislature and on boards and commissions and that sort of thing. Don't have it for women-owned companies, but that's an excellent question that would definitely be worth looking into a little bit more.
And Elizabeth writes, women who are in unionized workplaces have closer pay equity. At my unionized workplace, the women earn more per hour than the men on average. And I see both of you nodding, and maybe that's because, again, are the salaries publicized at that?
I think that's probably largely due to wage transparency. When people know how much people around them make, it's just harder to get away with inequity in salaries. And one of the things that was changed to Vermont's equal pay law last spring was protecting workers' ability to ask each other about how much money they make. It was already protected to be able to disclose your own wages, but your boss could still prevent you from asking your coworkers. And now that's allowed.
So listeners, I'm curious, have you asked for a raise? Women out there who are listening, what was it like for you? What did it take to get you to do it? And did you have a strategy in place? Did you get the raise or were you turned down a few times before you were successful? You can join our conversation today at 1-800-639-2211. Again, 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to South Burlington now and talk to Donna. Hi, Donna. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have to turn the radio off, I think.
Go ahead.
I Well, I had worked for several larger companies at some point and definitely made more money when I was there. I don't know how my salary compared with the other people. But I think that just the corporate environment, I just didn't feel like I was excelling in that environment just because I wasn't playing the game quite the way you had to play it. And so I ended up starting my own firm and working for myself. And I'm much, much happier, but one of the unfortunate elements of that is I don't make as much money as I used to working for a big company. It's just the fact of working for yourself. It's a tough game out there.
But Donna, don't you think that's a very common choice women make? They want flexibility. I mean, was flexibility right. What you were interested in when you made that switch, or was it job satisfaction?
For me, it was more job satisfaction because I was doing something that was quite specialized, and doing it in another, other companies just wouldn't give me that opportunity to pursue what I felt was a very important thing that other firms just weren't doing.
Sure.
And I really wanted to pursue that. And it's creating a new niche, and maybe someday somebody will be able to make a lot of money doing this. But when you're kind of out there in the forefront of things, you have to do a lot of educating, and you don't make money for that.
All right, Donna. Well, thanks for calling in. We appreciate it. Let's go to Cabot now and check in with Bruce. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to Vermont Edition. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm well. Go ahead.
I wonder if your commentators have a historical perspective to comment. I've been reading the history of the United Kingdom 100 years ago. Women suffragette leaders endured hunger strikes. They engaged in civil disobedience. One prominent one was even killed. We've also been hearing recently about a new biography of Stokely Carmichael, which brings me back to my youth and what people struggled and suffered for civil rights in this country. I think business is controlled by white men, and I don't think they want to pay attention. And I want to know, your historical view, why do you think American women have not been more militant about this?
More angry.
And would that help?
All right. Interesting question, Bruce. Carrie Brown.
Well, that's a great question. And, I think it's always a question to ask of why are people putting up with this, whenever you see any kind of injustice? And I think that there are because there are so many reasons why we have this wage gap, that helps to answer that question. A lot of it is really subtle. A lot of it is going under people's radar. They're not quite realizing it. A lot of women just don't know if they're being paid more or less. And then, when you look at the wage gap overall, some of it is due to choices that women make about what kind of jobs they're going to take, how much time they're going to spend in the workforce, whether they're going to take time off to have children. And those, I would not say that that legitimizes the wage gap. I would say that that helps explain some of it. But we need to go on and ask, why is it that women are making those choices in ways that men aren't necessarily?
Andrew asks, how is leave for child rearing figured into this 85 cents per dollar equation? My wife, for example, is not working because she's staying at home with our small children. It seems logical to me that when she returns to the workforce, that she will not demand as high of a rate of pay as when she worked years ago. So there's case in point. I think a lot of women make those choices. Cheryl Hannah.
Right. And that's really interesting because it actually works. It actually is probably works the opposite way. Let me give you a story about this. I had a student who was comparing two jobs. One was in another state. One was at a state's attorney's office. It was a relatively low-paid job. It was a unionized job, so her wages were transparent. And she said, well, if this offer, and I have an offer to go to one of the best law firms in the city, my wages will be more than double. But I'm worried about, it's going to be not as flexible. And I said to her, we have a misconception that low wage equals more flexibility. When in fact, the more you make, the more power you have, the more high status you are, the more flexibility you're able to negotiate in your career, not less. And so I think often women and men too make the misperception that I'm going to trade off salary for flexibility and time when really what you want to do is position yourself to be in the most powerful position with the highest wage earning so you have more ability and flexibility. So I always share that story because I think it highlights one of the misperceptions we have about the way world and work work. And we know that the highest wage earners are often the ones with the most ability.
Let's take another phone call now. Let's go to Anne, who's calling from Middlesex. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Some number of years ago, I worked at a place where women, it was all women working in a computer support office staff, and it was all men who were doing the order picking. And we knew that the men were making more money than the women. And we were bluntly told it was because they needed to support families. And so there was absolutely a barrier. There was absolutely no way that we could make any progress at raising our income at all.
And both my guests are nodding their heads. Carrie Brown?
Well, I actually thought that Cheryl might want to talk about this one because this is still happening right now.
Yes. I mean, so just to be clear, that's illegal. So in order for if an employer were to justify a salary based on somebody being the male breadwinner, even though women actually statistically are more likely to be the breadwinner than our men, that's just absolutely prohibitive under both state and federal law. That is not a bona fide legitimate business reason to pay a male more than a female. And I should also note, Nina, that there's also a misperception that an employer has to intentionally discriminate the way our caller says, right? They have to intentionally do that. But equal pay laws do not require people to be bad actors. They don't require somebody to say, oh, I'm going to pay him more than you just because he's a male or he's got a family to support. The law is intended to correct past discrimination that's unintentional, even if it results in a bad outcome. In other words, an employer could have what they believe is a very innocent reason for paying a male more than a female, but that still might not pass muster.
I want to get to a recent legal case that I'd like to have a few minutes to talk about. Last spring, there was a ruling in U.S. District Court in Vermont on equal pay that directly addresses some of the issues that we've been bringing up. I'd like you both to talk about the case of Wendy Dreeves versus Hudson Group Retail. Cheryl Hanna, maybe I'll start with you and just kind of explain what that case was about and why it's important.
Yeah, so this was a case that involved a woman who worked at Hudson News at the Burlington Airport and worked as a manager there and subsequently lost her job. And in doing so, she discovered that the person they hired to replace her was a male who was 10 years younger than her, but and had less experience, but was getting paid significantly more than she was. And let's be clear, he's not the bad actor in this, right? He came, got a new job, and when he did, he negotiated a higher salary. And one of the reasons his salary was higher was because his wife was giving up her job to come here and move with him, and the employer wanted to compensate him. I don't believe in this case anybody did anything intentionally to discriminate. But when the court looked at the case, they said the reason that the Hudson News gave for paying him more than her was that he was a better negotiator. And the court said there is still gender bias in the way salaries are negotiated. And that is not a legitimate business reason for paying a male more than a female. Simply the fact that somebody's a better negotiator and is bringing a spouse with them does not justify the wage differential.
Carrie Brown, I want to ask you, you know, from your point of view, why is this case important moving forward? How might it impact other decisions?
Sure. The case is important because it was the first time that Vermont's equal pay law was actually used in court. And I assume that there are other women out there right now who are wondering, am I being discriminated against? Is there a violation of the law going on here? And perhaps seeing a case actually go through successfully might give some folks a little bit of strength to investigate further themselves.
Hadley wrote in, I work for a private company. How can I find out what my coworkers earn so I can determine if I am paid comparatively? That's a big question.
You can ask them. They don't have to tell you, of course, but you can certainly ask them, and your boss can't tell you that it's not okay to ask. And your boss can't retaliate against you if you do ask.
And one of the things we were talking, I think, before the program started was the importance of mentors in a professional relationship. And I think men have had that for many, many years. And I think in Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, she talks about how important it is for women to have these mentorships with men and women in their business circles. Cheryl Hannah, how can those mentorships sort of help provide that inside information that everybody needs to succeed?
That's right. I think one of the most important things any person can do in the course of their career is to seek out a circle of mentors who can help inform you, not just about the specific salary of a job, but how you strategize over a career to really meet your full potential and to reach your career goals. And what a mentor can help you do is really both do that kind of assessment about what you bring and where you think you can go, and then what the market should bear for that skill set. So that those are really crucial, important relationships to make. And I've got to give people like Mary Powell credit for forming these Lean In circles to help women find mentors who may not otherwise be able to find them in their daily lives.
And Carrie Brown, just as a final question to you, do you think that's something that all working women in Vermont need to be more aware of and try to be more proactive in being mentors to maybe the younger employees that they're working with?
I do. And because we know that networking is beneficial, not just for finding out where the jobs are to helping to get them, but as Cheryl said, to know what they pay and how do you negotiate? How do you maneuver your way through a career? That kind of thing. And then there are also employers who may be interested in creating a more equitable work environment. And by having these conversations, they also can think about what can I do to reduce gender bias.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Carrie Brown is Executive Director of the Vermont Commission on Women. Cheryl Hannah is a professor at the Vermont Law School, as well as a regular VPR commentator. Ladies, thank you so much. This has been a great conversation. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, we're happy to be there. And happy Women's History Month. It's wonderful that we can celebrate it by talking about the progress women have made and keep working to move us further along.
Absolutely. Still ahead, listeners, we'll explain a quirky farm bill loophole that has tied federal heating assistance with food stamps. Vermont is one of about 17 states that will lose funding because this loophole no longer exists. We'll tell you what that may mean for Vermonters next. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kack. The new farm bill was signed into law a little over a month ago, and it includes $8.9 billion in cuts to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, what most people call food stamps. Those $8.9 billion come from eliminating a loophole known as Heat and Eat, which tied food benefits to heating assistance. It's a loophole that was used only by 17 states, but Vermont was one of them. And now state officials are trying to find ways to fill the gap in food assistance funding. Here to explain what the cuts may mean and how the state might work around them is Commissioner of the Department for Children and Families, Dave Iacovone. Commissioner, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Glad to be here.
So many listeners, I'm sure, are aware of the Federal Heating Assistance and Food Stamp Program, SNAP program. But explain to us what the quote-unquote heat and eat loophole is and how it tied those programs together.
Yes. Many years ago, a provision was made that allowed states to provide a nominal $1, $2, $3, $4, $5 annual benefit to recipients on fuel assistance that would help them get a larger three squares food stamp benefit. So what the federal government did, it said, if you're getting a fuel assistance benefit, regardless of the amount, we will allow, when determining your three squares benefits, we'll allow you to deduct from your income a standard utility allowance, thereby lowering your income. And the lower income you have, the larger the food benefit that you get. And a number of states, as you mentioned, have done this. Vermont, I think Maine was the first state. Vermont was the second state to do this, and we've been doing it since, I think, 2000. We've been doing it for a number of years now. Congress, though, said, in efforts to cut the budget, said they wanted to block this loophole and said, look, if you're going to do this, that benefit has to be more than $20 a year. And that's they've given states, it's complex, but it looks like we have 5 months to come into compliance with this.
And so if that goes up to, say, $20 or $21, how many households in Vermont are we talking about that receive this nominal amount of heating aid?
Well, it's over 20,000 households that receive this assistance, some 23,000 households that would receive help in this fashion.
And if the state has to bump up from that $3 to $5 of fuel assistance that they're kicking in for those households to $20, $21, how much will that cost Vermont?
That would cost Vermont approximately $295,000 to move our benefits from our nominal $3 or $5 benefit to $21. But it would allow us to bring in well in excess of $6 million a year in Three Squares benefits. That's very conservative. That number could be higher, but that's our most conservative estimate. So it's a significant payback. Where else can you spend $295,000 and yield over $6 million?
It's a good deal, definitely. But if this doesn't work out where the state ends up paying this, how much the federal food supplement money might Vermonters stand to lose?
Well, that would our conservative estimate is $25 a month, which is over $6 million a year. The Shumlin administration is recommending to the legislature that we do not lose this important safety net funding for Vermonters, and that we change Vermont law, which is necessary, to indicate that we will provide this nominal benefit of $21 annually to preserve these benefits. And the legislature is taking this up for consideration as we speak. I believe the House Health and Human Services Committee has recommended to the House Appropriations Committee that we make this change. And I believe they just did that today in a written form, which is great.
So remind me, how much food assistance do most households in Vermont receive right now?
Well, on average, it's $243 per month is the average household benefit. That goes to some 100,000 Vermonters, roughly 50,000 plus or minus households. And it's about $140 million a year right now.
And so you mentioned that the money that might be lost from the SNAP program would be about $25 a month?
That's correct, conservatively.
All right. You were talking about efforts right now among state lawmakers to change the state statute to raise that $295,000 so we could qualify for federal dollars. Again, remind us what the schedule for that is. How is that flowing, and how optimistic are you that those changes can be made?
I am optimistic. We've been well received in the legislature, certainly by the Committee of Jurisdiction in the House Human Services Committee. They certainly understand the need to make this change. I also think it's important to point out that Vermonters on Three Squares sustained a $10 million annual reduction back in November when Three Squares was reduced. There was some what we call ERA provisions, some economic stimulus provisions from the Great Recession that went into effect, and benefits were reduced. So this is real important, because this, if we don't make this change, that's on top of that $6 million conservatively that we mentioned, is on top of an actual $10 million reduction. So I think in folks have been very sensitive to trying to do what they can do to mitigate this reduction as much as possible.
Well, and it's interesting that New York and Connecticut have already made these changes, and I think many of the 17 other states affected are considering what we're considering. You know, if we pay a little bit, we'll reap all these benefits in federal funding. So here's my question. You know, lawmakers in Washington were thinking that they'd have this big $8.9 billion in savings in the new farm bill. But if every state sort of does an end around and seeks out the federal funding anyway, is that federal money saving, the $8.9 billion that's expected to be saved, off the table?
Well, there's speculation that Congress will likely revisit this next year if indeed a number of states do what we're considering and New York and other states. So I wouldn't be surprised. So the savings that they had hoped will not likely be achieved, and then they'll have a policy decision to make whether they want to revisit it or not.
Because I think New York State had, 40% of that federal?
Yes.
So with them off the table right away.
It doesn't take long. That's right. That's right.
All right. Well, Dave Iacovone, I really appreciate your time.
You're entirely welcome.
Dave Iacovone is commissioner of the Vermont Department for Children and Families. And you're listening to Vermont Edition. And now we turn to your messages and feedback on Vermont Edition. Producer Rick Singeri joins me now with a few of the comments you've sent in. Hi, Rick.
Hello, Nina. Let's start with last week's discussion about the three new gun ordinances that were passed in Burlington. Because they are charter changes, they must be approved by the state legislature and signed by the governor. Polar Vortex writes, at what point should majority not rule? If the state does not approve these charter changes, what other types of changes will they not approve of in the future? How much power do towns want Montpelier to have over their local issues?
Many of you responded with nostalgic stories when we interviewed Elizabeth Von Trapp about the death of Maria Von Trapp and her family's legacy. Donna wrote in 1975, when I was in the fifth grade, I played the part of Maria in my school's production of The Sound of Music. Our director knew Maria and arranged for cast members to travel to Stowe to meet her in person at the Trapp Family Lodge. There we enjoyed hot chocolate and the best chocolate cake I think I've ever had. Afterwards, Maria posed for pictures with us. A very memorable event and a very special lady.
And Carol shared this. My Sound of Music moment came when I first visited the farm that I later purchased in Springfield. I felt just like I imagined Maria felt in the opening scene on the mountaintops. I get that feeling every day now.
Oh. Last week, we took up the issue of declining snowmobile usage across the state. One of our guests was from the Vermont Association of Snow Travelers, or VAST, and Meredith in Heartland writes, I'm happy to hear VAST get its due. My husband and I did not ride sleds, but we use the VAST trails to walk with our dogs and goats a couple of times a week. We have never had anyone get impatient with us or be anything but polite and accommodating.
Jean is not so happy with snowmobilers. She writes, anyone claiming that snowmobiles are quieter these days clearly does not live where I do. A tiny handful of local snowmobilers persist in making endless loud loops for hours each day through our residential rural neighborhood, riding on town roads and not respecting private land. The rest of us living here end up feeling like we're spending several hours each day living in the middle of a NASCAR track.
And Jean continues, while I have no doubt that the majority of snowmobilers using VAST trails are responsible and respectful, there are far too many others who are not. And that all too common occurrence undermines the tolerance many of the public have for snowmobiling in general.
Last week, we also discussed Vermont's high risk for embezzlement. Our guests hypothesized that part of the reason financial fraud was so frequent here was our small-town trustfulness. Gregory agrees. I moved here from a dense metropolitan area, and what I have noticed is that in these small towns, everyone knows everyone's business, yet discussing personal and legal failings is seen as bad form. You'd be surprised at the people who have robbed their neighbors through fraud and embezzlement and are still members of the local community.
Gregory continues, I think this reluctance stems from a tacit agreement not to display everyone's dirty laundry, because we all have dirty laundry.
Oh, we do. And we're not afraid to hear what you think about it. You can write to us at vermontedition@vpr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we're still getting emails about the wage gap.
That's right. Carla wrote in on our Facebook page, I eventually asked for a raise, and I got one. But it really isn't easy. I think we women are so accustomed to having to work our tails off for everything, we may subconsciously believe someone has to be noticing and waiting to reward us. But they aren't, and they won't, until we tell them they need to.
And Doreen wrote in, I would ask that you not refer to the heat and eat connection between LIHEAP and SNAP as a loophole. It is a way to make the SNAP program more fair. For those whose heat is included in their rent, they receive less in Three Squares Vermont benefits because they cannot deduct their heating costs. This connection makes it more fair and mostly affects low-income Vermonters, especially those who are elderly and disabled. And that refers to the discussion you just had with Dave Iacovone.
Right, and that conversation will continue online at vpr.net. You can read what everybody's been commenting. Hey, thank you, Rick.
You're most welcome, Nina.
And that's our program for today. Tomorrow, we'll look at the efforts of labor unions in Vermont and how they fit into the national labor picture. Do you belong to a union, or does your business have a unionized workforce? Tell us what you've observed about the role of organized labor in Vermont. You can write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed our program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Nina Kack. Thanks for listening.